At Central Piling, we have a fleet of continuous flight auger, rotary board and driven rigs of various sizes. This caters for most piling and retaining wall needs. Our team's technical, logistical and operational strengths provide clients with a reliable and flexible build solution across England and Wales. We pride ourselves on understanding the environment within which we work and being a responsible contractor. To ensure greater efficiency and meet our growth targets, we are always developing our people, plant and services. We now offer a plant and operator hire service, including ancillary equipment. For more details, please visit centralpiling.com or phone 01787 474 000. That's 01787 474 000.
Hello, welcome back, hopefully, to another edition of the Breaking Ground podcast. We're joined today by Paul Beatham from Nottingham Trent University. But before we meet him, let's have a little chat with Kieran again. Kieran, how are you? Are you busy week, I guess, with AGS conference this week? I don't know if you were in attendance personally, but...
I was actually on the school run in the morning whilst the team were schlepping into Victoria at about 4 in the morning to get everything set up. So I'm told it went really, really well. It was very, very well attended, actually. And there's an enormous amount about sustainability, which is a subject that's close to my heart, as you know. So,
And you did it at the Institution of Civil Engineers this time.
That's right, yeah.
Barbican last year, wasn't it? Yeah, great venue, of course.
Yes, of course. I mean, it's such a sort of fantastic space, and the team at their end is really helpful as well. So, and Barbican similarly, actually, we've had good experiences.
Yeah. With
that. So, and the great London spaces as a Londoner, I'm very proud of those.
Yeah, 100%. I noticed, I'm sorry to put you on the spot. I noticed there was somebody from the pension regulator at the conference, which is quite different for the geotechnical.
That's right. I think he was talking about green finance, which it's a really interesting topic, particularly in the EU, where they're bringing in what they call the taxonomy regulations, which are all about creating a skew. It's quite technical, so I'll try not to go too deep into it. But, but basically, Mark Carney, when he left the Bank of England, went and set up this enormous green investment fund of something like, I don't know, $1 trillion or something. And taxonomy in the EU is this way of skewing investment towards sustainability. So the conditions for the way it works is that you get cheaper finance for a project or something that you're doing if you can show that it's not causing any harm on, I think it's six or seven, something like that. So for example, you'd need, if you're showing that there was a net biodiversity gain through something that you're doing and you weren't, you're carbon neutral and not doing anything on the other measures, you'd then qualify for this cheaper finance. It's basically a way of skewing the money markets and investment markets towards the sustainability agenda and making it sort of advantageous to be sustainable, which it sort of currently isn't at the moment as we sort of transition from a high carbon economy to a zero carbon economy. So yeah. So I think he was there to sort of talk
about...
Sounds
intriguing.
it's intense.
Yeah, anything where there's the possibility of free money, I'll put my hand up.
Exactly.
Certainly have to find out more, and for a good cause, of course. And our friend Ebenezer was also there promoting the mentoring scheme, which is fantastic. So that... has seen a few changes this year with the way we're running it. I think I've touched on that in recent podcasts, but I know that it's really key to provide feedback to the members of the Ground Forum that support that mentoring scheme, which, just as a reminder, supports roughly 40 undergraduate students, pairing them with industry mentors, giving them opportunities for work experience. And really sort of give them a bit of a leg up in their career. So it's important that we feed that back to the people that are supporting the scheme financially and in terms of the time that their employees are putting in as well. And yeah, it's been a really busy week. Pylon and Foundations conference from EMAP was also being held this week. So lots happening, things in the news as well. So a bit disappointing news, I think, coming out of the Middle East in terms of the way that NEOM's been scaled back, really quite dramatically. So obviously it's not a UK project, but it could have ramifications for the likes of Keller, who are obviously UK based. So we'll have to see how that moves forward. But I suppose as quickly as they can stop a project like that, they can start it again. Any thoughts on that?
I guess
that
one, yeah. Kim? I mean, for those who aren't aware of the NEOM project, I mean, it's a series of projects, I think, in Saudi Arabia, where they're investing huge amounts of money into building. One's a sort of winter resort. One's a sort of arcology type city in Jeddah, I think it is. And then the line, which is one that they've just scaled back. The line was this slight, if I'm being honest, a slightly crazy idea, I think, of a linear city that was going to be something like, I don't know, is it 100, 200 miles long, something like 200 kilometers long, built out in the desert.
But really now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's basically this big reflective glass wall. It looks like something out of a science fiction movie. And they had enormous ambitions around, you know, creating this whole sort of new way of living in a way that hasn't ever been sort of tried before. I think from the outside looking in, it always looked like a hugely ambitious visionary project, I guess, but one that was always probably going to be in danger of this sort of thing happening where, you know, you're trying to build something that's never been built before in a sort of quite a difficult environment. So the costs of it were likely, I think, to sort of spiral, perhaps. I don't know, but they've cut it down now to about a mile of city.
Yeah. It's difficult to get a handle. I've not been to the region as to whether there is sufficient demand for housing in that area. Who will live
in that city?
I don't know. Maybe there's a real demand in the major cities in Saudi Arabia for more housing.
Yeah, I mean, I spent some time in Saudi Arabia as a child, but it's been something like 40 years since I was last there, so I can't give any up to date impressions on that. But yeah, I mean, I guess they felt there was some pressing need to do it, but I also think it may have been the strategy may have been related to them looking ahead again to a future where fossil fuels are not what they are. You know, the demand for them is not what it is today. So, you know, perhaps part of that green transition. I don't know.
That was a big part of the sales pitch, I suppose. Was it Kevin Costner said, "Build it and they will come"? Was it Milton?
No, that's Kevin Costner in Field of Dreams.
Field of Dreams. What a film.
Classic.
Right. Let's, on that note, let's bring in Paul. Paul, how are you?
I'm great, and I'm especially happy to come in on a 90s film reference.
What's your favourite 90s film? You got to stand out.
Be the Shawshank Redemption. That was the all-time classic for me around then.
Classic.
Always scores well on IMDb. I think I'll go with Top Gun. Is that 90s? I think.
That was 80s, about 85, 90s. I think. You're fine.
Oh, was it? Gosh. What's it?
Don't show your HD.
well, that says something for Tom Cruise's longevity, doesn't it? We're here to talk about lime stabilisation, by the way. Paul, how many years have you been involved with lime stabilisation? Does it predate the Shawshank Redemption or indeed Top Gun?
I can say that the aspiration came from around about the Shawshank Redemption, but actually didn't start in it until 2006 was my first site.
Okay.
So that was actually, I use that as an example, that site. I use it as a case study on my training course that I do, because it's probably a example of borderline where you should use lime stabilisation, because the earthworks contractor had mixed a whole load of topsoil into the cut and fill material, mixed all the different fill types together, and then continuously scraped all sloppy bits of stuff off during winter working. Coal had been mixed into all the different types of fill and rubbish, and it was just literally an absolute mess of a site. And so it was probably one of the most challenging sites I've done. And that was my introduction into the foray. So that didn't kill me, so I kept on going.
Well, I suppose we should discuss what lime stabilisation is all about, where lime's from, presumably limestone, but there's a process that you have to go through to extract the lime from the limestone. So maybe you could explain that, and then talk about the chemical process of using lime within a soil mixture to change its properties. So maybe start with the extraction.
Okay, so you start off with about 3 hours worth of content, but yeah, we'll have a go. I'm not an expert in lime manufacture by any stretch, but I'll do my best to kind of summarise. Yes, it's sort of a pure source of limestone is needed, and probably about 90% plus pure calcium carbonate would be what they'd aim for as a source. Then they'll process that down into something that can be fed into a kiln, and then it's heated up to, you've got to decarbonate, you've got to drive out the CO2 from the calcium carbonate to make it CaO, calcium oxide. And so that does require temperatures in the order of around 800, 900 degrees centigrade. So lime manufacturing as a manufacturing industry, they're going through a big drive to decarbonize, and they're investigating methods of how to undertake that without using the temperature, because there'll be a lot of geologists perhaps on the call, and we've all got geological backgrounds, but you can use pressure, you can use other chemical ways of driving that carbon dioxide out. They all work in the lab. It's scaling them up to the industrial scale that the industry is currently working on heavily. So, of course, they have their own decarbonisation agenda.
So the kiln's coal-fired at the moment, is it? But they're looking at electric kilns.
I can't really talk for the manufacturers, but I would have thought there'd be gas. Okay. Because the residue of the coal, because I used to be a kiln burner in a cement mm-hmm. plant, which you might talk about later, the residue from the coal would be absorbed into the feed, and that can cause some minor constituents that might be a problem. So I don't suppose they would use coal, but they might. Like I say, I'm getting out of my depth a little bit on that. So. So then it's kind of ground, and that does use electricity, into a powder, and then that becomes the product. Now, lime is used for loads of stuff in the UK. It's not just used for lime stabilisation. Probably the biggest use is in water treatment.
Right.
And so there's other things that they might do. So they turn it into hydrated lime, so that they would slake it in the plants, as I would understand. Mm. So there's other things that might go on for other industries. So lime is used for, it's an extremely useful resource in this UK that probably a lot of people don't actually realise that we rely on it for so many things. Toothpaste, for example, finely ground limestones in toothpaste, not lime, not calcium oxide, but finely ground limestone. So yeah, so there's lots and lots of uses, but the one I'm interested in, of course, is when you mix it into the ground, because the great thing about calcium oxide is when it comes into contact with water, it has a immediate exothermic reaction to hydrate it and turn it into calcium hydroxide again, I suppose you could say, and that has a tremendous drying effect. So with just even a very small amount of a percentage of lime, so let's say 1-2%, you can dry out very wet of optimum, sloppy, horrible clay that we see in the winter and the spring that we're still having. That's a major problem for construction sites, because we know that you can barely traffic plant unless you've got a firm sub base that you can start from. And so just that ability to mix in and quickly condition the material within minutes, that would be what we call lime improvement. So the process of
dehydrates the soil. Is it, so this lime, is it going to be a powder or is it going to be a liquid form? Presumably powder form, if it's drying it out.
So in the UK, the vast majority, 99.9% of the time, it's a finely ground powder. So we'd call that class one quick lime. Because you want it really fine, so it reacts really quickly. Yeah. And the finer it is, the quicker it will heat things up, basically. It's like your basic chemical reaction type stuff. Because we want to dry things out fast, and you want to make sure that you don't have any non-hydrated lime still in there, that once you've compacted the layer, which would be the next thing that kind of happened, you don't want that to hydrate after you've compacted it because it's expansive. And then you'd get, you know, some heaving inside your layer, which we all know would be a bad thing. So usually the more reactive, the better. However, when I say that, this treatment can be used for treating sediment dredged from lagoons or for enabling works onto your bogs, basically. So there's been incidents where if you use too much quicklime powder with extremely wet material, you can drive up so much heat that you can cause thermal plumes, and the thermal plumes will cause dust clouds to lift out the ground, because such is the extent and the rate of the reaction in such extreme ground. Now, what you'd do in that case is you'd use flakes of the lime. You can get you can even get nodules, which would be like about 10-20 mil lumps of the lime, which is how it comes out the kiln before it's ground, and they're less reactive. And so you'd still get the drying effect. It'd just be much slower, which is far more applicable to a situation like that.
Okay, so if we think about it in use for improvement of platform, let's say a piling platform, as it's close to my heart, are we looking at feeding the quicklime, which, by the way, I'd always envisaged when I heard the term quicklime as a liquid. that's a key takeaway for me today. Yeah. So do you feed that into the machine with the soil, or do you just treat the soil? So let's say you've got the sub base. It's a soft clay. Do you just sort of sprinkle the lime powder on top of the clay, or do you mix it up, churn it all up in the machine, then relay it? What's the regular process for that?
So to do things in the most expedient way, you'd have what you call a spreader, which is a tractor-toed, well, kind of what it says, a box with that spreads the lime out in a controlled way. And that would run in front of the rotivating machine, which is a separate piece of plant that would come on behind it. And so that would be, so prior to this, you'd have it's almost like an extension of normal earthworks. So you'd have your normal earthworks layer run out, which, let's say, it's nominally 300 millimeters thick. Then you'd run the spreader over the top, which would distribute it at the target rate, let's say 1%. And then you'd have your mixing plant, which is, if it's a dedicated Vertgen or Bomag type machine, these are about 40 ton machines, and they move slowly. They move at walking pace. And then inside them, they've got a large mixing drum that's got kind of teeth, would be the best way, that stick out from the mixing drum. And that rotates it with high torque. And it passes through the 300 mil layer, and it will then efficiently mix in the lime binder in and around. What will then start to happen is the lime starts to mix into what was a sloppy mess probably before that. As the lime starts reacting with the soil, it starts to dry it one, but then also the other reactions that go with this, they change the clay particle structure. So the calcium switches in for some of the, I don't want to get too chemistry, but it switches in for some of the cations that are attached to the surface of the clay particles, and that changes their structure. So the clay structure becomes more aggregated, grouped together, so it acts more like silts rather than individual clay particles. That reduces their water demand.
Yeah, so you're getting an angle of friction as well as a cohesion within the clay.
And also it effectively raises the plastic limit of the material, because the surface area of the particles in contact with the water is reduced. And so even the same moisture content, the same material becomes a bit a drier feeling and easier to work with. And so all that happens within seconds and minutes as it's mixed. and then in the period shortly following on before the kind of the final compaction. And so you very quickly, you'd take a, and so what your normal process would be, if you're just going, we've got to break up the difference between lime improvement, which is just to condition it to OMC, say, and optimum moisture content for compaction. So you'd be targeting, and in stabilization, we very often use MCVs, moisture condition value test. So that's, for those that don't know what that is, it's just a rapid test that you can do that's essentially an index that tells you how close you are to the moisture condition, the optimum moisture content. So we'd go with usually around an MCV test of 13 is going to be very close to the optimum moisture content for 2.5 kg lab compaction. And it's a very quick test that an operator can do, a technician can do following behind the machine, do it in 15 minutes and then tell you, is the material good to compact or does it need to be processed again? Because you can over dry the material, and in that case you'd need to mix in some water, which you'd hope that you've got facility to do, because not always, but or you might need to put a little bit more dry more lime in to get the moisture condition down and also get it more pulverized, so the clods finer, so that they
so you do need to do that compaction after, right. So the in terms of the strength of the material and the mechanical properties, what is the time effect? You said it's quite an instantaneous reaction. Could you literally treat the soil, compact it, and be putting machines on it within 24 hours? Or do you have to leave it for, I don't know, a week for it to really gain the optimum strength to suit the material properties that have been used in the platform design?
So if it's a pilot mat, this is a specific application for a pilot mat. I'd probably say if it's earthworks, generally, like you might need to build up several layers sometimes. If it's earthworks, it's just a continuous process to get you to an OMC. If it's piling mat or something that has a particular structural performance, and that could be a sub base, you would either have to wait, and I'll explain. I can tell you about lime pozzolanic reactions afterwards. But the normal thing to do in the UK is, because we have zero patients to wait any time, and this is an opportunity to become more sustainable. Let's plan better. Mm. Let's allow time for things to become hard and stronger, because you've already put the thing in that will allow it, but you might have to allow in your program 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks for that to do its work. But because we're so reactive as an industry, nobody allows that time in, and that just forces us to be less sustainable. So, because what you'd do instead is you'd use the lime in a, so if it's a cohesive film material, when I say cohesive, I mean, let's say it's got a plastic index of 10% or higher, you would need to do what we call a two-part treatment. So that would be the lime in first. And the reason you put the lime in first is one, to get it to the right moisture condition so you can process it, but it reduces the demand for water that the clay particles have. Because what you'll do next is that you'll need to mix in some cement. And I say cement, but going forwards, this can be more eco binders, as we'd call them. Alkali activated calcined clay, you know, could be something that we'd use instead in the future. But let's stick with just the word cement now, because I think everyone knows what we mean when I say that.
But this is always part of the process, is it? Cement.
For a piling mat where you wanted to use it within less than 1 week, certainly.
Yeah, okay.
And you might well be able to use it within 2 days, something like that.
So it just speeds up the hardening process. But if you, and you're, as you discussed, if you were prepared to wait longer, lime independently would potentially increase the strength.
If it's a case of 10% plasticity index or higher material, because what you're aiming to do something different when you do lime plus cement stabilization. One, you're aiming to get the clods fine enough. For cement stabilization, you would aim for 60% of the fill passing a 5.6 mil sieve, which is pretty fine if you think about it. It's a as a clay material. And then what you want to do with the cement that you're rotivating afterwards, you're essentially treating those as aggregates that now have a low water demand, with the lime reducing their demand for water, and you're cementing those together. And so you're actually bonding at fine points of contact between them. Whereas if you were to use lime stabilization only, you'd be relying on something called pozzolanic reactions, which require the lime to diffuse deeper into the clod, and it makes the clod itself stronger. So it's a bit like taking a squidgy bit of plasticine, and then the chemical that's making it solid is migrating into the center of it and firming it up. And it's the time it takes for the lime to migrate into the clod, and also for it to start causing the reactions, which I haven't said anything about, to actually happen. And that takes time. And when I say time, and this is where, you know, the programs would go completely out the window if it were to be the analogy to HS2 work that we've done recently. So we've done innovation work. So we've been curing, I think, 4,000 kilograms of material that we treated in various different ways, and then looked at long-term strength development for over a year to see how long it takes. And it's between 90 and 180 days where the kind of the peak starts to develop. But it's a continuous strengthening, right? So you go from day naught up to that 180-ish days, but it starts to taper off, you know, as you go. So it depends what you're targeting. Where, you know, when have you hit your strength that you're targeting, not just the most it can get. So, so it's a time-based thing. So if you did have patience in your program to wait for the reactions to do their thing, then you could get the maximum out of this. If you do your testing at 28 days and assume that's all it's got, then you'd be massively underestimating the potential. And I think that's the shift that has to happen in the mindset of designers and engineers, perhaps, just to realize how slow that is. And when you have got the program, because HS2 does have the program, because the earthwork, the embankments have been built over, you know, 3, 4, 5 seasons. So we've got the time for that strength to kick in and have the full benefit of it. So you don't need to use the cement.
Yeah, it's a slightly different application there, which maybe I'll loop back to. The other thing that perhaps affects it, and I was cycled in this morning, actually, and I've got to say my body wasn't working very well in the cold temperatures.
Friday.
I can imagine. that doesn't help. Yeah, what the temperature effects on the sort of dehydration process and the strength gain? Is there an impact from that as well?
This is something that we've worked on again on some of the HS2 work. Low temperature or winter working weather. So in the current, as it's kind of written in Series 600 spec, it does read as to say you need to have a minimum temperature of 7 degrees, and you should only undertake stabilisation from March to, I think it's September. And so that's quite a curtailment in the programme on HS2 and any project. But it's a bit more, when you look at the global specifications, they're a lot more open. It very much depends on where you are. So if it's cold where you are, they tend to have much lower minimum temperatures. So, for example, there are examples in the Midwest of the US where they've got very cold winters, where the minimum working temperature was -1 centigrade. But we've got 7 degrees centigrade in our specs for some reason. So we did a series of works where we prepared the stabilized, so it'd be lime, 1.5%, 3% lime, and then compared it to lime 1 plus 2% cement comparisons. And we prepared them in 3 degree, 10 degree and 20 degree environments, having stored the soil in those at those temperatures as well for 2 weeks before it, to see what the difference in strength gain was. And yes, at the 20 degree temperature, the strength gain is certainly much quicker. But even at 3 degrees, we found significant. And I think after 28 days, we had a CBR of over 30%, even at 3 degrees curing. And then we shifted those samples to 10 degrees. The strength gain slowly starts to recover and move towards the trends of the higher temperature ones. So preparing it at low temperature is not in itself a problem. It will slow down the rate of things, but again, it's back down to when do you want a certain temperature by, and do you have scope to wait for it? The absolute, though, is free. You can't work in freezing conditions, and that's probably obvious because you don't want water which has expanded by 9% of its volume to then dissolve and leave voids in your fill. So there's certain obvious limits to where you can't go beyond.
Yeah, there's a bit of a restriction. You know, you think about platforms, they tend to be poorer in the winter months, and so not being able to use this application during that period, does sort of limit the potential use of them, which is maybe one of the reasons why we've not seen a wholesale use of them in the past. I'm trying to think of some other downsides, and I know that's maybe not in your interest to talk about, but I think it's important to sort of discuss it. Is there any kind of environmental or safety issues with regard to the use of lime, which is a high alkali material? Could you, for instance, I don't know, use it in an area that was going to be a playground, and you've got kids? Is it sensitive in terms of a kosh?
Do you mind material? If I just like follow up on the last bit about the working platforms?
Yeah,
I will answer that one for sure. The problem with a barrier towards using lime stabilization or any kind of stabilization in temporary working platforms is the design standards or the methods that the contractors will use, that a contractor or a piling specialist would use. So, for example, if we take BR470, which, and correct me if I'm wrong, Steve, because you're the specialist in this area, but I would say that's probably the most used standard for temporary works design.
Yeah, possibly people would argue that it's rather over conservative in its approach, but at the moment it is adopted by the vast majority of the industry. Tensar have a slightly different approach, which has been used quite a lot with geogrid reinforced platforms, but the temporary works forum method and the BRE method are the most common ones.
There are about 8 globally, I think.
Okay, that's interesting. you have to let me know what those are. The two that we kind of focus on with some of our recent work, the three would be those two that you just mentioned, but they all fundamentally concentrate and focus on the friction angle of the working platform material. I understand why, because historically that would be an assessment of the quality of the working platform material. But stabilised material, lime-treated and or cement-treated material, is fundamentally a bonding process. So it would effectively increase the apparent cohesion, if you want to think of it like that. There might be some changes to the friction angle, but there would be a much smaller contribution to the strength. So let's say 80% of the strength that's added is probably cohesive. And if there is no way of accounting for that in the method, it's a fundamental barrier for a designer to be able to specify and be confident in stabilization, because they've got no way of recognizing the benefit that's given with the two most common methods. And so until there's kind of some way to reset that, then it's almost like a block that stops it from being used and pushes, you know, the granular approach, and that becomes very difficult or unsustainable.
And we've been talking mainly about improving clay soils. Does lime improve, let's say, a loose sand, a sort of cohesionless made ground? Is there any benefit from using lime in conjunction with those materials?
So you wouldn't normally need to, because your granular materials, in terms of an earthwork or a sub-base type material, they're not usually that sensitive to water. I mean, they might be, but usually the water content, because they're relatively free draining, the water will not be an issue in terms of compaction. So unless there was a reason why you needed to regulate the water content, then lime wouldn't necessarily be that big a benefit, and actually it might make it just too dry. Whereas usually if you were to seek stabilization, then you'd use more of a cementitious type binder in that, a more immediate reactive bonding type binder.
Oh, got you. Okay, thanks. And we were talking earlier about embankments and obviously the use on HS2. That must present its own sorts of challenges. So you touched on swelling as being something that could be a problem, which I suppose is more impactful with an embankment than it might be for a working platform.
Yeah, so I suppose swelling, there's probably two ways I'd think about that. One would be just the natural clay minerals that can expand. And just fundamentally, because lime would cause aggregation and cause them to act more like silts and reduce surface area, then it would help with that. But a particular type of swelling, which I've been heavily looked at, is the reaction with sulfates. And so if you've got gypsum or pyrite, which can oxidize to form gypsum in the ground, then by adding lime into that, you can cause a series of negative reactions. So the pyrite oxidization in itself, if you've got pyrite, you add in water, high pH, that will very rapidly oxidize the pyrite and cause the conversion to buffering and conversion to gypsum. And that's about 103% volume change. So just that process would cause that volume change. And then once you've got the gypsum, it can then cause what we call sulfate swell, which is where the calcium, the alumina and the sulfate all want to draw in together to form something like ettringite. And that draws in lots of water. So it's like if you've got surface water that's accessible to this, or capillary action that can draw up water from deeper down, then you've got a mechanism to draw water into the fill, and it can cause continuous expansion. So, and that would be 37% expansion, and it can just keep going. And actually, at the average temperature of the UK, the mean average air temperature of the UK is about 10 degrees. It happens much, much quicker at that temperature than it would do at 20 degrees, which is where most lab tests assess its impact. So this thing called sulfate swell. And so in the UK, where we have a sulfurous potential, and we're all familiar with this because we've got, you know, a special digest one, which look at for concrete classification. So we're very used to, as an industry, doing our TRL 447, or hopefully we are used to doing TRL 447 oxidizable sulfate and water soluble sulfate assessments. So it's no different really, I suppose, from concrete. You've got to be aware that it's something that can happen, but as long as you go about it in the right way to identify it as a risk, and then if it is a risk, take appropriate measures to manage the risk, then you can work with it. So it certainly is a thing, but it's not this, I suppose, epic problem, insurmountable problem. It's what I would call something that can cause rare failures. 99% of the time, you won't have an issue, but it's in that 1% of the time where it can go wrong, and if you aren't doing the right procedures. But that's like any construction process, I'm sure.
Therefore, again, just sort of reinforces the need for a proper ground investigation to do that process properly.
Absolutely.
Which we know from sort of conversations within AGS and elsewhere is... It's always a fraught area because often it's not insufficient is commissioned at the outset of a project to really understand what's in the ground.
Absolutely.
So what are the mitigation measures, Paul, for embankments if you've got a sulfate issue?
So I go kind of, in terms of my risk, when I look at something, how risky is it? One, first of all, you'd look at your sulfate measurements. And if you've got any indication that you've got between 0.25 and 1% total potential sulfate, then you might start to twitch a little bit. And you're like, I've got to look at this very carefully. Then after that, if you're seeing values above 1% TPS, and also by knowing the formation, the geological formation, you just know where you are in the country, just how risky the area you might be. So if you're in the East Leek in the South Nottinghamshire, which is where they mine gypsum, then straight away, you know, in your head, you've got word association games. Or if you're near Banbury in Oxford, you know, you've got potential big issues with your Jurassic your lower Jurassic clays and pyrite. So you know you've got this risk thing in your head going on. After that, it would be what is the regional groundwater looking like? If the water is draining towards where you're going to be working, then that's certainly that's the second bit of alarm. If you're moving up and out the ground rather than cutting into it and there isn't kind of a regional drainage issue, then there's almost like very little reason why it would then develop into a big problem, because it's water that's going to drive this. And if water isn't going to drain into it or be drawn up into it, then this isn't going to propagate. So that's the second part. Thereafter, you'd then move into, even if you still do have those in place, you still want to be sure, because if you get any kind of failed drainage or other issues with surface water flow into this, you still can still have problems. After that, it's kind of a hierarchy of the more lime you put in, I suppose, the more potential you could have for the problem, because the more calcium there is, the more high pH there is, the more there is to fuel it. Then it would be, can you switch in something that's not calcium-based to cause the same effect? And so the classic would be lime plus GGBS, because GGBS, blast furnace slag, is basically a source of silica and alumina that will react with the calcium nice and quickly, and it will cause bonds that aren't swell-prone. But we have a big issue with that going forwards in the UK, because all of the slag is destined to be used in concrete mixes, and we don't really produce very much of it ourselves. You know, and fly ash, the same. They now have the same benefit, but just not as pronounced. All of this is going into the concrete mixes, or it has to be imported from overseas. So we kind of need another focus to find to replace our blast furnace slag going forwards. Otherwise, we don't have our actually primary mitigation strategy. And then good workmanship is the next one, because if you place your material with good compaction, targeting OMC, get all your pulverization, your workmanship going on, that is your fundamental protection. Because when you do that, then you should have a very low permeability material, and permeability is the driver, because it's water coming into it. So there's a big link between, in my mind, there's a big link between workmanship issues and sulfate swell problems as well.
This is a big topic, bigger than I realised. I think we're going to park the lime stabilisation here for a moment. We've got other things that we want to discuss on this podcast. But before we leave the lime stabilisation area, can you give the listeners some recommendations for articles to read or books? Or I know that there was a terrific presentation that you gave the ICE Northern or North Midlands division that's available online currently. Where else can people find more about this topic?
Yeah, so I'll blow my own trumpet first. So I wrote the review paper in 2015, I think it was published. It's called Lime Stabilisation for Earthworks, a UK Perspective. And that is a ground improvement journal, ICE publication. And you can find that if you look on my institutional repository, NTU IREP, if you just search NTU IREP, and then Lime and then Beetham, you'll find me, BWETHAM, and you'll find me, and you can get that from the repository. You can go through the paywall at the ICE, but you might, you know, obviously want to get the free version. Sorry, ICE.
It's all right. We pay enough subs between us.
That's true. So that was my effort to take all the academic knowledge at the time and make it relatable to practice, because I found that I'd read all this stuff that was all very lab and very microscopic, and I didn't know what the heck it meant for an earthworks process. So I thought I'll try and compile all that and make it mean something to a practitioner. And I think that's led to, you know, a lot of why people then contacted me afterwards. So that's a good starting point. After that, we've got the BritPave Soil Stabilisation Task Group. So if you just Google BritPave, they've got some great publications on there that are free. You have to just put your details in, but then you can download them for free. So there's best practice guidance for soil stabilisation. They've got an industry definitive guide. So that's a really good one. As a starting point for people looking into it. It's 4 pages, very client friendly. So if you wanted to send it to a client, that's good. They've also got one recently called Forward in Soil Stabilisation, which is picks up on some of this work that I was talking about earlier. So we're getting that out there as an initial, get that in out there quickly before the journal papers that have a much slower review process can follow on. So that then is also, I've just got this next to me because I've just been to the European Lime Association roundtable this week. The Belgium Road Research Centre wrote a code of best practice for soil treatment with lime. Again, this is free download that you can get from their website. And that's, while it's got a European focus, a lot of the information in that is very relevant to the UK, mainland Europe focus. Very relevant because we work closely with the European Lime Association as a consortium with the UK. So we're very aligned to each other's practices. So that's nice. So those are the top three I'd say for a practitioner to want to know more about this without getting too academic.
Okay. One of the other areas that really I wanted to discuss with you is your journey into academia, because I don't think it was necessarily the usual route. Can you just explain a little bit more about how you ended up as a professor at Nottingham Trent?
Yeah, it's weird when you think about where I started from. When I finished my GCSEs, I didn't think about the future at all. I literally just expected it to be the same when I went back to sixth form. But what happened was all my friends left that were there previously, and I didn't even bother asking them that question. And I picked to do physics, maths, and English, I think, for some reason. Anyway, I didn't have a very good time at high school. My physics teacher wasn't the nicest person to me, and he just basically stood me up in class one day and said, "You're too stupid to understand the most basic of material. You know, you need to reevaluate your life choices." And he did that in front of the class, you know, to a 16-year-old lad, which I thought was, you know, when you think about it now, how savage is that? So I did reevaluate my life and thought it's not the productive place for me to be at. So I applied for an apprenticeship in cement manufacture, got the apprenticeship and said goodbye to the abusive physics guy. And then I started that journey thinking, and I was so anti-education at that point, right? I was thinking about this the other day because I bike as well, Steve. When you're biking, you think a lot because there's a lot of time, just you, no distractions. And I was thinking, what was I like when I was 17? I remember being in the pub one night and I was trying to chat a girl up who was at a university. And I was doing this apprenticeship and I was so proud of myself because I was like, I've got some money, I'm not paying. As part of my technique to chat her up, I was saying, why are you at university? It's a total waste of time. You know, you need to get a job, you know, and then you can get some money. Because I'm just like really naive thinking I'm giving her some advice. And she's like, why is this guy telling me my life is terrible? And so,
for younger listeners, chatting up is how you used to meet people.
yeah, you don't do it on WhatsApp or Tinder.
Break your flow there.
It's all right. Well, I think my flow was well and truly broken after I started talking like that. But so I was really anti. I was like, you know, I'm going down the street. I'm going to be I want to be the works manager. That was my kind of thinking. But I started doing evening classes. And so I went back to the education and I got my A levels. And I was like, well, I'm all right at this. So then I'll do a part-time degree. So I did a part-time geology degree at Derby University. And that was literally the best thing I ever did. You know, very much supported by Blue Circle or Lafarge at the time, very supportive company. They paid for my part-time degree. But I worked my night shift and I'd go into university and then do my day study. So it took me 6 years. I also couldn't believe that students couldn't turn up for 9 o'clock lectures when I'd just worked a night shift and I could still be there. I still can't believe students can't turn up for 9 o'clock lectures, but that's just kind of a permanent thing. So I ended up getting a scholarship to do an MSc in geotechnics because they quite like the look of my dissertation that I did. That was David Manning at Newcastle University. I remember these names. And that got me a scholarship to do geotechnics at Newcastle. And then I met Stephanie Glendinning there, who's now Pro-VC of, I'm not too sure what, but doing incredibly well. But her PhD was in lime stabilization. And she taught me geotechnics. And that re-triggered. I'm like, well, I really loved cement reactions from this time that I spent in cement manufacture. I ended up hitting a glass ceiling in the cement world. So I had to leave. And that's why I ended up doing the MSc. But I always loved, I wanted to be a concrete technologist at that point. I was like, I love the technical side and I love the cement hydration. So I'm like, well, this is an opportunity to go back into that through geotechnics now in lime stabilization. Well, actually at that time, nothing really happened with that other than I was had some interested chats with Stephanie. But I then went to work for in consultancy as a geotechnical consultant for 5 years. And then I ended up doing supervising this soil stabilization site that I started off talking about. And then I met with the director of the company and we got on well. We had a really difficult site, a really difficult problem to solve, but we worked together. It was a classic NEC 3, although we're NEC 4 now, aren't we? It was a classic NEC 3 collaborative working. If everyone is embodied client, contractor and engineer, everyone would get the best out of this process. And it was like that. And at the end of that job, because it had gone well when it should have gone badly, he basically said, I'd like you to do something for me. Do you want to research lime stabilization? I'll pay for your degree. I'll pay for your scholarship. I just want you involved. And so that's what happened. And so I ended up doing the energy engineering doctorate at Loughborough, supporting the director, he's called John Bateman, I'll name check him, Independent Stabilisation Company in Chesterfield. And I helped him out with his designs for over the 4 or 5 years that I was doing that. And he just basically paid for my degree and then left me to it. And he said, tell me something interesting at the end and I'll be pleased. And I did, and he was. And so I ended up working at Loughborough in the labs a lot, and I was seeing their lifestyle, the lecturers. So you've had Neil Dixon on the podcast, I think. And the other lecturers there, really nice guys, and they're just so happy with what they were doing. They moan, everyone moans about their work, don't they? Yeah, there's little moans, but they're just generally like comparing them to what, you know, some of the things that I had seen. They've got a nice life, you know, and I want a bit of that. So I thought, I'll now migrate into academia.
There was a lot of golf being played at Loughborough for a period of time, I've got to say, by the geotechnical department. They're all in single figures.
I'm not having to walk away from this being that Loughborough academics play golf and dock around. They do excellent work.
Work extremely hard. They're worth every penny and have progressed things. But they do seem to have life in balance.
It's work-life balance. And again, I think academia was ahead of the curve on that. I don't think I had very good work-life balance at certain times. I think it's a lot better probably 10 years on from where I, 15 years on from time flies, 15 years on from where I was. So work-life balance was where I was going for.
I think we're undergoing a bit of a sort of revolution in that space, to be honest, because my sense is that the generation coming into work now have radically different expectations around what work should be. And because there's such a sort of skills shortage, you know, people are hungry for people. So it's sort of, I think the pendulum has swung in favor of the employee at the moment. So I think we're seeing better working conditions and that will probably continue. And I've heard even in Germany, I think it was Bauer saying they were trialing a 4-day working week on site with a view to attracting younger people into the industry. So, you know, which is quite, you know, I was surprised that they went that route. Yeah, I was surprised that they went down that route actually, because my experience of, you know, sort of with Bauer over 10 years has been, they've been, you know, they're an excellent company always, but have been quite traditional, I guess, in their approach so on. And so I think they've, you know, they are embracing new thinking.
Well, you need so much buy-in, don't you, to get that to work. You need the client buy-in, the main contractor buy-in, and obviously from the crews. Sometimes there's there's a desire, we've seen it in our own business, to work, people want to work longer hours. I mean, this is a whole new, whole different conversation, which we was easily put up podcasts, and I think we've in the past. But rewinding to your degree, Paul, it was a part-time, and we're seeing more of this now, you know, a real push for degree apprenticeships, which in a sense it was, but under a different name. And I wonder whether you're seeing a real demand from students now to go on a degree apprenticeship rather than a traditional 3-year, 4-year course.
Definitely, yeah. No, I absolutely totally agree that maybe it wasn't a defined thing, but what I did was essentially what a degree apprenticeship was. And we have them at Nottingham Trent. We do degree apprentices, and we started them, I think, 6 years ago. And so we've now had we're having our first year intake from 5-6 years ago. They've now gone through their endpoint assessment, and they're coming out as incorporated engineers. So that's what I really like about the degree apprenticeships as well.
They're professionally qualified
Yes. So we're now getting our first lots that we took on. They're coming out with the IENG. And I think that's fantastic because it's not just a degree. It's the initial professional development. And then and then they've got a clear pathway then. So you can then go on to CEng with the career appraisal. And the IC is great at having other routes now to match that. So we absolutely are seeing more and more intake of that. And that's what we're doing as a university. We're trying to diversify and provide more options at the apprentice level. So you can come in and check out at what we call level 4, which is almost, and also level 3, which is your A-level. HND. In our Mansfield campus, we're doing a very applied skills course. So it's construction skills, particularly in retrofit, to retrofit houses with insulation and to be more energy efficient. So that's a very practical course, not focused at becoming engineers and designers. That's actually having the skills capacity to do the work on site, because that's another skills crisis that we have as an industry. So we're trying to diversify as a university. We're trying to provide more and more diverse apprenticeship type options, not just degree apprenticeships, but yes, we do those as well. But to pick up the full spectrum, because we know that the traditional degree is tailing off. You know, there's less people now coming in year one on the traditional degree. So we need to pick up those numbers by providing the right offering to where the money is, where the employers are taking people on.
I remember when the degree apprenticeship idea was first floated, and there's been a geotechnical degree apprenticeship set up probably in the last 2 years. There was a discussion amongst the Ground Forum, and there was a sense from some of the members that somebody with a degree apprenticeship couldn't possibly come out as the same level of student as the person that had done a straightforward course, that it academically it didn't carry the same weight. I didn't believe that, because I remember doing a year in industry when I was at university, and my final year, I felt like I was twice the student I was in my second year. So in a sense, it would be similar to that. What's your experience of the levels of student abilities comparing, this might sound a bit harsh, comparing people that have done a kind of straight 3 or 4 year degree against somebody that's gone through the degree apprenticeship route?
It's an interesting question, because you've got the pool size that you compare it to, and kind of traditionally we would have had about 100 to 150 students per year on the traditional route. And then starting off with our first cohort of degree apprentices, there might have been 10. So there's an order of magnitude difference that you're comparing of a body with. I think the truth is people are people. You'll have high performers in all different groups of people. When the grouping is small and it's on trial, naturally the better performing or the higher quality candidates will go into the smaller selection pool. And so there will be a skew just because of the process. As right. things start to number up, and I kind of see it, you get more diverse people, which is good because you don't want anyone to be excluded from the process as long as they can engage in it. I think you'll probably find there won't be any actual difference. It's more down to what that individual's individual circumstances are like. Do they want to commit to work hard, really apply themselves to their degree, or are they distracted by playing rugby or something like that? You always get that across a cohort. And it's what you want to do with your life as well. Some people really want to push their careers when they're younger, and some people just want to have a career. You know, we all have friends like that, you know. And so I would say what you need to do is have the option for both, so that you can pick up the best and also the general population that are going to be solid engineers. They're not going to break the mold. They're not going to push the boundaries at the top end, but we need enough solid, good engineers. There's always going to be a 5% problem at the problem in everything, but the 95% is doing the job, and both options are great. Anyone that sits there saying this option isn't as good as that one because I did this, they're just protecting their background for some reason. I don't know why. You just need to be open to, is it going to get a good result? Is it going to help? We've got a skills crisis. You need help in every avenue you can get. All these routes are viable. So I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, great opportunities. Yeah, and talking of opportunities, you mentioned to me in a previous call, you provide employment opportunities for students on campus through an association with a materials testing company.
Yeah.
Can you just talk a little bit about?
Yes. This has been my one of my babies for the past 18 months. So what we've been doing is turning our geotechnical lab, which is already decent, you know, and it's an excellent teaching space. But I kind of realized that it's only kind of timetable for teaching 10% of the time, and then it's used for dissertations and things and research projects for PhD students. But as a resource, it's probably 60% available plus. And then at other times of the year, it's nearly 100% available over summer and things like that. So I was like, well, let's commercialize it, because we can, one, help with some issues. Turnaround times in geotechnical testing have not been great recently. And I started conversations with Socotec, who are the partner that have ended up really supporting this initiative. And they were saying, we have a turnover problem. We have our own skills crisis, because we get in soil technicians, and then we lose 10 to 20 staff in one lab potentially a year. And that's really difficult to work with, because it's not easy to train them up to become productive. And so I said, well, we've got a resource. Actually, the reason why I found that out, because I went to their lab in Coventry, and they had a whole room full of effective stress and automatic consolidation equipment. And it was, the lights were switched off and nothing was happening. So I said, why are you not using this room? And I said, have you not got the work? And he goes, no, we've got work coming out of our ears. You know, we just haven't got the staff. So all the staff are doing classification tests at the moment. They're all doing earthworks testing, because that's the more urgent work, and we can turn it out quicker. So we're just not taking on the effective stress work at the moment because we can't staff it. So I said, right, I've got 500 students that want jobs. You know, they're desperate for work because of the cost of living. They're desperate to improve themselves, to make themselves more employable. Let's see what we can do. Can we set up a commercial lab in our university? And one, we get our students a job. Two, we get a unique selling point for our course. We're the course you can come to work in a living, breathing geotechnical lab. We help you out of your skills crisis. There's so much win to it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it sounds like a model for people to follow. Kudos to you and Nottingham Trent for setting that up. I'm afraid it's just about got to that time where we're going to have to call this one to a close, but really enjoyed our conversation, and I'm sure we'll be bumping into each other at various events in the months and years to come. Thank you so much, Paul.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me. It's been fun.